enjoy the show.
From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a new day for U.S.-Cuban relations, latest on the Ebola outbreak, South Sudan refugees on the rise, plus what's happening to Russia's economy. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Obama has announced a major shift in U.S. policy toward Cuba, begun dismantling the decades-old embargo against the Havana government. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez has our report.
A new era in U.S.-Cuban relations.
Good afternoon.
President Obama announces that after a half-century freeze, relations with Cuba are thawing.
I've instructed Secretary Kerry to immediately begin discussions with Cuba to reestablish diplomatic relations that have been severed since January of 1961.
The changes? Talks will start on reopening the U.S. Embassy in Havana, and restrictions will be eased on banking, commerce, and travel to the island, until now largely off-limits to Americans. And there is also a prisoner swap that includes the U.S. release of three Cuban spies in exchange for one American intelligence officer held for nearly 20 years. President Obama said he had received a personal appeal from Pope Francis, but it was Cuba's release of USAID contractor Alan Gross from a Cuban prison and his return to the U.S. on Wednesday that brought the president to announce a change. The embargo has stood this long due to pressure from Cuban Americans. Criticism from Florida Senator Marco Rubio was quick and strong.
This president is the single worst negotiator we have had in the White House in my lifetime, who has basically given the Cuban government everything it asked for and received no assurances of any advances in democracy and freedom in return.
But praise did come from Cuban leader Raul Castro in an address to the Cuban people.
Esta decisión del presidente Obama.
The decision by President Obama deserves the respect and recognition of our people.
To actually lift the embargo, President Obama needs the approval of a soon-to-be Republican-controlled Congress. Those talks are to begin soon. Luis Ramirez, VOA News at the White House.
And in that prisoner swap, Luis just mentioned, U.S. Agency for International Development contractor Alan Gross was freed on Wednesday by Cuba. He had been in a Havana prison for 5 years, charged with importing banned technology to Cuba. Another person was released. The U.S. President Obama described him as one of the most important U.S. intelligence agents. They were exchanged, as Luis just mentioned, for three Cuban intelligence operatives who spent more than a decade in U.S. prisons. When Mr. Gross arrived back in Washington on Wednesday, he thanked Mr. Obama and others for helping to get him freed. He also spoke about the Cuban people.
In no way are they responsible for the ordeal to which my family and I have been subjected. To me, Cubanos, or at least most of them, are incredibly kind, generous, and talented. It pains me to see them treated so unjustly as a consequence of two governments' mutually belligerent policies.
Cuban authorities arrested Alan Gross in December of 2009. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison for importing telecommunications equipment in order to set up an internet service for Cuban Jews. Also in the news, a Nigerian army court has sentenced 54 soldiers to death for refusing to fight against the group Boko Haram. Soldiers were charged with mutiny and cowardice after they refused orders in August to help retake three towns held by the Islamist militants in northeastern Borno State. A lawyer for the men said Wednesday the five other soldiers tried in the court-martial were acquitted. The convicted soldiers, all members of the Army's 7th Division based in Maiduguri, are to be executed by a firing squad. Nigerian soldiers have complained that they are outgunned by Boko Haram and often sent into battle without adequate supplies. East African nations are expecting South Sudan's refugee numbers to rise dramatically in the coming year as more people flee violence and a deepening humanitarian crisis there. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports Kenya's top diplomat also says her country will keep pressure on South Sudan's political leaders to agree on a peace deal.
Humanitarian agencies say the number of South Sudanese seeking refuge in neighboring countries could rise to 821,000 people next year if a lasting peace is not achieved soon. The expected upsurge would add to more than 500,000 South Sudanese refugees already living in Ethiopia, Kenya, Sudan, and Uganda. United Nations agencies and NGOs working on the crisis launched an appeal Wednesday for more than $800 million to fund the refugee response in the host countries. The crisis in South Sudan began a year ago when a political dispute between the president and his deputy spiraled into an inter-ethnic conflict that has divided factions of the ruling party against one another. Negotiators from the warring sides are scheduled to meet in Addis Ababa this week to continue to work on a peace deal. The process has been uninspiring, as at least four past ceasefire agreements have all been violated. Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Foreign Affairs, Amina Mohamed, speaking to reporters after the launch of the refugee response plan in Nairobi, said Kenya continues to have faith in the process.
So at the political level, we're doing everything that we can. And I can tell you that we've made a lot of progress, but we are not there yet. We've made progress on all the issues except for issues that relate to security and the governance structure.
Kenya is part of the IGAD group of nations mediating the talks. The group has threatened sanctions against South Sudan leaders from both sides of the conflict if they cannot abide by a lasting ceasefire deal. Meantime, Kenya is also considering a new security bill that would, among other things, cap the number of refugees allowed in Kenya at 150,000. Mohamed said she did not think the bill will have any effect on refugees in the country or the appeal for funding.
The bill is not yet through. It's just gone through its first reading in Parliament. It's still under active consideration and discussion. I don't think it has any bearing at all on the request that we've made to the international community today to support the refugees that are already in Kenya.
Kenya currently hosts more than 500,000 refugees, most of them from neighboring Somalia. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
And now back to South Sudan. A lot to be angry about there, especially among the young, far better educated generation, which feels alienated by the leaders who've waged a war for power at the expense of the people just 2 years after independence. But to date, there has been little public protest. Analysts say that tens of thousands of refugees and jobless have no time for taking to the streets. Their main concern is just to make ends meet. Benno Mushler reports now from Juba there is possibly another explanation. South Sudan is a military state that suppresses opposition.
Michael Dengadwell is a refugee. He is one of about 50,000 who have sought safe haven from the fighting at a United Nations site near Bentiu, a strategic town near some of South Sudan's most important oil fields. It has changed hands many times during the year-old conflict. On a recent morning, the 26-year-old primary school teacher recounted his difficult experience.
Even me, I come here through difficulties. I spent about 5 days in the bush without drinking any water. I taste also even the urine. I drink the urine.
Deng has a lot to be angry about. He came here almost exactly 1 year ago, just about when war broke out. Since then, he says he has led a life that seems no better than that of an animal. Flies swarmed around his head while he talked, sitting in a heated mud hut covered with plastic sheets. The UN camp stands on a barren field with no escape from the South Sudanese sun. Food, water, and electricity are scarce. But the worst part, people say, is having nothing to do and feeling imprisoned because outside the camp it's too dangerous. Asked why no one protests against their elected leaders who are responsible for this situation, Deng had this to say.
The problem is that Africa, and I can say Africa in general, is different from Europe, is different from USA, is different from other continents. In South Sudan here, we say that South Sudan, we use democratic system. And that one, it remains in the books. If you make a protest now, you can be killed.
South Sudan is a military state. Soldiers and guns are omnipresent. The government is mostly made up of former guerrillas, with no room for outsiders who did not physically fight for independence that became reality 3 years ago. The Sudan People's Liberation Movement Party rules the country with an iron fist. In the history of many countries, it was often a student movement that began a struggle for change. But following ethnic clashes between students at Juba University 2 years ago, the school administration banned student associations. Outside the university, medical student David Tut Ali said they fear to openly speak their minds.
And it's very difficult to express our feelings. They just talk of freedom, freedom, of which freedom is not in place, it is not in action.
Many students shared his opinion but feared sharing their names because of South Sudan's security service. After three more student interviews, a man in plain clothes approached, insisted in Arabic to follow him to a police station, and took my journalistic accreditation. I asked a nearby soldier to be my translator and follow me as a backup. After a five-minute walk, the plainclothes officer relented and then told me to report to him the next day. Deng Atuay Mawir, one of South Sudan's most outspoken government critics, knows all too well the risks for activists. As the head of the South Sudan Civil Society Alliance, he has challenged the government of President Salva Kiir and his former deputy-turned-rebel Riek Machar many times. 2 years ago, he was kidnapped. And just a few weeks ago, he says an unknown gunman almost killed him on the street.
I start the car. Somebody came out on other right on the side, and he shot. I heard the bullet turn. He broken the both windows, and he missed me here. And then from there, I just came out. The second shooting shot me from here.
Today, Deng Atuay Mawir lives in a secured hotel of a friend that he seldom leaves. But he doesn't want to go in exile. He said South Sudan is his country, and he wants to correct the difficult situation that his people are in. Benno Müchler for VOA News, Juba.
World Health Organization Wednesday said more than 6,900 people have died so far of Ebola, almost all of them in West Africa. As of December 14th, there were more than 18,500 cases of infection in the three worst affected countries, Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. While infections and deaths are rising, the disease is posing a greater threat to food security. UN agencies warn that more than 1 million people could be food insecure by March unless action is taken now. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The UN Food and Agriculture Organization, World Food Program, and the governments of the three countries have just surveyed the food security situation. A joint statement calls for drastically improved access to food, as well as measures to safeguard both crop and livestock production. Alexander Jones is the chief of FAO's Donor Relations and Resource Mobilization.
Well, obviously, the most urgent priority of FAO and all of our UN partners is to stop the epidemic and the loss of life that's caused by it. But we also need to keep in mind that there is a need to reduce the food security impacts of this crisis, which are equally challenging. This is having both direct and indirect impacts on millions of people in the three main affected countries in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone.
The UN agencies say access to food has been blocked by border closings, quarantines, hunting bans, and transport restrictions. Livelihoods have been disrupted, and food markets have been closed for long periods. Jones says the harvesting and processing of food has either slowed or stopped in some places.
These are countries, of course, which have a very large rural agricultural sector. It's taking labor force away from these areas. Normally during harvest and other critical agricultural seasons, there's a large inflow of population from other areas. And obviously this is not happening with all the quarantines and movement limitations placed on them. So there's an absolute lack of labor force in this area.
Farm workers no longer have the salaries they did prior to the outbreak. Their lack of spending is also contributing to an economic slowdown in the countries. The FAO's Jones says farmers that are able to produce some crops are having a tough time selling them.
So we're seeing that prices in production areas are dropping and they're rising in consumption areas. So typically rural areas have less income with which to buy things they need, and urban areas are seeing price increases.
Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone have been forced to import more food and are not able to export crops to neighboring countries as they have in the past. The FAO and the Africa Solidarity Trust Fund have donated more than $3 million to food security efforts. But officials say millions of dollars more will be needed. Meanwhile, The World Food Program's Emergency Response Coordinator, Denise Brown, describes the Ebola outbreak as a wake-up call for the world. She says, while working with partners to make things better, we must be prepared for them to get worse. To make things better, UN agencies are trying to reestablish the farm system in the three countries. This includes distribution of seeds and fertilizer, better agricultural methods to help compensate for the labor shortages, and cash transfers or vouchers to allow people to buy food and help stimulate markets. Currently, it's estimated 520,000 people are severely food insecure in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. UN officials say without urgent action, that number could double by March. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says he will be visiting Guinea, Liberia, Mali, and Sierra Leone, as well as Ghana, the site of the UN mission for Ebola response. On Wednesday in New York, he said he wants a firsthand look at the Ebola response and to show solidarity with those affected by the illness.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Russia's currency, the ruble, has recovered by about 10% after falling sharply in its value this week as the government pressured exporters not to hoard their foreign currency. We get more now from VOA's Daniel Scherf in Moscow.
The Russian ruble regained some ground Wednesday in volatile trading, but investors remain nervous about the currency's stability. Russia's central bank spent billions of dollars this week propping up the ruble after a jump to a 17% interest rate failed to arrest its decline. The Russian currency this year lost more than half its value and on Tuesday alone dropped at one point by 20% before recovering about half the loss. The ruble's gains Wednesday came as Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev met with the heads of export companies, including energy giants Rosneft and Gazprom. He urged the exporters to rhythmically sell their foreign currency earnings rather than save them to help stabilize the ruble. Russian exporters, which are paid in foreign currency, are one of the few sectors of the economy that benefit from a cheaper ruble because it lowers the prices of their products abroad. Importers are among those most suffering from the currency's decline as foreign goods cost more. The ruble's decline makes it more expensive for Russian companies to pay foreign debts, raising concerns that some could be forced to default. Rising inflation and an expected recession could move Russia from an economic crisis to a political one. President Vladimir Putin rose to popularity when high oil prices filled government coffers and fueled growth. Falling oil prices and Western sanctions for Russia's actions in Ukraine fueled the sharp drop in the ruble. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Moscow.
Rajiv Biswas, chief economist for IHS Global Insight in Singapore, told VOA's Victor Beatty it's definitely the Western sanctions over Ukraine that have sparked Russia's economic woes.
Of course, these sanction measures are now very much implemented and are starting to also have an effect on the outlook for the economy because Russia doesn't have access to the necessary technology anymore for its vital oil industry. But really, the biggest problems have come since the slide in the oil price because Russia's such a dependent economy on oil, with much of its exports and fiscal revenue depending on oil, that they're extremely vulnerable to such a sharp decline in the oil price. And I think that's really what's pushed the ruble down very sharply in recent days. And we're now basically in a situation where the Russian economy is in a deep crisis. The outlook is for a recession next year. And the question is only about how negative is it going to be. At the moment, the Russian Central Bank itself is talking about minus 5% GDP growth next year if oil prices are around $60 a barrel, which is about where we are now. So It's going to be a very difficult outlook for the year ahead for the Russian economy. And most of all, it's because of the oil price. Capital flight through the course of 2014 has also been a very negative factor for Russia. There's been an estimated $130 billion of money that has left Russia during the course of this year because investors have feared the consequences of Russia's intervention in the Ukraine and also the deteriorating economic outlook. So all of these factors have really continued to destabilize the economy. When we look at the credit rating, the sovereign credit rating of Russia, it's still an investment grade rating, but given the deteriorating economic situation and the sharp deterioration in the fiscal outlook as oil revenues collapse, I think there's a real risk that they could also be downgraded by at least one or more rating agencies to junk very soon. And that will, of course, have a further negative effect on their economy as well.
President Putin insists this is a temporary situation. Do you agree with him?
Well, it's as temporary as the oil price is going to be weak. I think that's the situation right now. And our view is that the outlook for oil is continuing to be relatively weak over the next couple of years. We think 2015 will, you'll have oil in the region of around between 60 and 65 for Brent crude. So that would imply a very negative outlook for economic growth in Russia because their budget is based on $100 per barrel for oil. So, of course, with oil at 60 or perhaps even lower, their revenues are going to be deeply affected, which means big expenditure cuts. And also, although we do expect some improvement in the oil price outlook by 2016, it's still going to be relatively modest. We expect about between 70 to 75 for Brent crude in 2016. So that still implies quite a lot of fiscal difficulties for Russia, although it would be somewhat better. It's really going to be very much linked to, firstly, the oil price, and secondly, of course, whether sanctions will be maintained. So if there's some sort of political progress by Russia in terms of the Ukrainian situation, they may be able to alleviate some of the stress if sanctions are rather diluted or removed altogether. But really, the key, the heart of the problem is the global oil price.
Ms. Wass says the net effect of the Russian economic downturn will be limited to its close trading partners in Central Asia. President Putin's popularity has been based on an oil-driven economic growth that has boosted economies and income there during his 15-year tenure. Biswas says over time, the popularity may erode, especially if inflation begins to take a toll on Russian consumers. And Lev Gudov, head of the independent polling for Levada Center, says Mr. Putin has about an 18-month store of popular support, but says that could be eroding next year.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians. This
with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
And Sony Pictures has canceled the release of a film about a fictional plot to assassinate the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un after hackers threatened to attack theaters showing the film. U.S. Department of Homeland Security says it's analyzing the latest message, but insisted there is no credible intelligence to indicate an active plot against movie theaters. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on International Edition at The Voice of America. Good to have you with us. Latest world news is coming up shortly. Hope you'll stay with us for that. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Thursday.
This is Today in History. On December 18, 1271, Kublai Khan renamed his empire Yuan, officially marking the start of the Yuan dynasty of Mongolia and China. In 1865, Secretary of State William Seward proclaimed the ratification of the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution, banning slavery in all U.S. states and territories. The amendment became effective 8 months after the end of the American Civil War, which started after southern states supporting slavery seceded from the Union. In 1912, Charles Dawson announced the discovery of Piltdown Man, supposedly an ancient ancestor of humans. Piltdown Man was later discovered to be a hoax, although the identity of the hoaxer is still unknown. In 1916, French forces basked in their victory over the Germans in the World War I Battle of Verdun. It was one of the longest battles in history, and although the exact number of casualties is disputed, perhaps as many as 700,000 soldiers lost their lives. In 1946, movie director Steven Spielberg was born. He's one of the best-known American filmmakers. His movies include such blockbusters as E.T., Poltergeist, and Empire of the Sun. In 1956, on this date, Japan was admitted to the United Nations. In 1957, the world's first full-scale atomic power plant, located at Shippingport, Pennsylvania, began producing electricity. Commercial nuclear power generation was a cornerstone of President Dwight Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace program. In 1966, a short film version of Dr. Seuss's classic, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, aired for the first time on American television. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Much has changed in the three decades since HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, was identified. Even as recently as a decade ago, a diagnosis of HIV/AIDS seemed like a death sentence for an entire continent, said Secretary of State John Kerry. Back then, more than 2 million people died from AIDS-related causes on a worldwide basis. Today, we've cut those numbers by 34%. Back then, AIDS threatened to wipe out a whole generation, leaving behind 14 million orphans and vulnerable children. Today, we've slashed new infections among children in half. The tide has turned, said Secretary Kerry. We are fighting the disease, and an AIDS-free generation is in sight.
PEPFAR is now supporting life-saving antiretroviral drug treatment for 7.7 million men, women, and children. We're providing HIV testing and counseling to more than 14 million pregnant women. We're training more than 140,000 new healthcare workers to deliver HIV and other health-related services in AIDS-affected countries.
But the battle is not yet won, said Secretary Kerry. So the United States is intensifying the fight against this terrible disease and introducing new strategies. First, PEPFAR is collaborating with the Nike Foundation and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in a $210 million public-private partnership to achieve an AIDS-free future for adolescent girls and young women in up to 10 countries. Second, we will invest $116.5 million to strengthen the capacity of health workers to deliver life-saving HIV services and also help address other public health threats across Africa. Third, through the Accelerating Children's HIV/AIDS Treatment Initiative, PEPFAR, and the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, over the next 2 years, we will double the total number of children receiving life-saving antiretroviral treatment across 10 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. We are also working with our partners to accelerate the development of new pediatric medicines. Fourth, PEPFAR and the Millennium Challenge Corporation are partnering to invest $21.5 million toward creating country-driven local data hubs that will include data critical to controlling the epidemic, including health, poverty, and gender data, and will be used to improve strategic planning and quality of care. The United States' commitment to combating HIV/AIDS through PEPFAR and our long-standing support of the Global Fund is as undiminished as our work is unfinished. We can achieve an AIDS-free generation, said Secretary Kerry. We can and we will defeat this horrific disease.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.